It's been 11 years since the second volume of John Richardson's four-part comprehensive biography of Picasso was published. Now, at last, I have the third volume in my hand. And it's received, if possible, an even more positive critical response than its predecessors. A Life of Picasso, The Triumphant Years, 1917-1932, is published by Knopf, and I'm pleased that it brings John Richardson back to this show. Hello.
Hello.
How long ago did you begin this very long project?
I've forgotten it so long. I think it's about 25 years.
Did you have any idea that I was going to take it?
No idea. I don't think I'd ever embarked on it. I wouldn't have embarked upon it if I'd known what a long time it was going to take. I mean, I've been working on this last volume for 9 years.
Why has it taken so long? This is an important time. This is when he emerges as a world-famous artist.
Well, I was amazed to find that nobody had really worked over the life at all, and it was all new territory.
I mean, despite all the books that have been
written
about Picasso?
Despite all the books. The books are about, you know, Picasso and Surrealism, Picasso and Dadaism, Picasso and the ballet, Picasso. But nobody's ever really done the life, and what, because, and there, that's where all the clues are, and everybody had swept Olga, the wife, under the rug. And I was lucky in that Bernard Picasso, the one legitimate grandson, Olga of Picasso and his wife Olga, the Russian ballerina, had inherited an archive which nobody had gone through, and Bernard very kindly let me go through it, and there are marvelous photographs, unpublished photographs, which tell you a huge amount. Also, even there's a home movie that Picasso made of sort of life in the country at his Chateau Boisgeloux around 1930.
Do you think that you would have undertaken this incredible project if you hadn't known Picasso?
I don't think I couldn't have done it if I hadn't known Picasso. And I've been really very close to him in the 50s, on into the 60s, and then I came to live over here. But so long as I was living in Provence near him, I mean, I really had constant access to him and became... I'd always been a fervent fan from the age of 13. But to find myself, you know, knowing him, I mean, was a joy. And I think he sensed that I was going to write something, because he was very helpful to me and gave his blessing to an earlier version of the book, which I was going to do.
And the family, as you say, has been generally supportive.
Very
as well,
supportive, yeah.
Especially his widow, Jacqueline Roque.
Yeah.
But the Picasso who I know from these books is rather egotistical and not always the most pleasant person. Was that apparent to you at that time?
Well, I think, no, it wasn't apparent, but whatever one writes about Picasso, the reverse tends to be true also. I mean, he was so paradoxical. And if you say that he was stingy, he was stingy to his family, I mean, because he was a control freak, but he was incredibly generous to his friends. If you say that he was an atheist, as he always claimed he was, only look at the work to see that, I mean, there's masses of references to black Catholicism, to all kinds of Catholic references in his work.
You have broken his life up into different sections. What determined that this section would be 1917-1932? 17 is after he's kind of left Cubism.
Yes, I mean, that was a good starting point. And I wanted to go on to Guernica in 1937 when the Spanish Civil War breaks out. But I just got so much stuff, I couldn't, you know, I thought the book would be too thick and fat and heavy for anybody to read in bed, and much better bring it to a halt. When Picasso, in his 51st year, I mean, after he'd realized he was going to be 50 and reinvented sculpture and reinvented his own style of portraiture, and for a big exhibition in 32, and I thought that was a good time to end.
When you say he reinvented sculpture, he and Julio Gonzalez came up with a new approach to sculpture that has pretty much been one of the standard approaches ever since, welded steel pieces. Is it Picasso who reinvented it, or is it Julio Gonzalez, as some people claim?
Well, it was an invention of the two of them. And Picasso, the inventor, so-called inventor of welded sculpture, never welded anything. He was far too nervous about hurting his hands. I mean, he wouldn't drive a car because he didn't want to he had this crazy idea that driving a car was bad for your hands, and he tried to dissuade Braque and other friends from driving cars. Very dangerous for your hands, he said.
Why?
I don't know why he had
steering wheel.
This
idée
fixe.
It's dangerous for other parts of your body if you crash into somebody.
I would have thought, yeah.
But he rode cars.
And he loved cars, and he had this great big Hispano Suiza, and he had this amazing driver who became a kind of everything, assistant, studio assistant, pimp, you name it. And then,
but everything, but he didn't worry about that man's hands.
He didn't worry about that man's hands, but he did worry when Marcel smashed up an American car he'd just been given by an American dealer, and then Marcel was fired and went to the Ritz, where he might well have been driving Princess Diane, because he was part of that crew of the Ritz drivers for many years.
Well, Picasso didn't do his own sculpture. He didn't do his own graphic work. He didn't do his own ceramics. And yet he is credited with making major pieces in all of
now,
those media.
Now, I slightly disagree with you on that. The ceramics, I mean, he really worked at, I mean, on the potter's wheel. And, I mean, he broke all the rules in ceramics, and he sort of engraved the pots, bent the clay around, did all kinds of things nobody really had done. And he was very hands-on with that. And I think the same with his prints. I mean, he did everything. I mean, he unlike Andy Warhol, he didn't have assistants who were sort of doing all the work. With the prints, Picasso worked like crazy on them, and all that the assistants did were to ink the plates. And they are beautifully inked by the Cromlech brothers in particular.
Mm, they also did the lithographic process,
yeah,
because that's very difficult. I know that I tried to learn it in college and never really mastered it.
And worse if it's in color when you have three plates or four plates to deal with.
My guest is John Richardson, whose latest book is the third volume in his life of Picasso, the years 1917 to 1932. How old is Picasso when we begin this part of his life, and where is he?
When we begin the book, he's leaving Paris for Rome and Naples in early in 1917. World War I is still being fought, and Picasso was delighted to get out of Paris, which was within range of Big Bertha, the huge gun, and the German's gun, and he was delighted to get away to Rome, which was not a neutral country by any manner of means, but there was no sort of hint of the war, not much hint of the war there. And
he was there with Cocteau.
He was there with Cocteau. He had been turned down by two girlfriends who he'd proposed marriage to. And these two women he loved them, and they had great romance. He had a great romance with both of them, but they felt in the end that they couldn't sort of, they'd be demolished by marriage to Picasso, and they were quite right.
And he was looking for marriage as much because his family was pressuring him to produce an heir?
Yes.
Or was he, because he doesn't strike me as the marrying kind.
Well, I think that Picasso had a very bourgeois streak, and I think that his family had been trying to get him to marry a sort of good Spanish girl, but, I mean, that was not his cup of tea. And so he had all these affairs in Paris, but then it came to a point that he really wanted to settle down, and there was pressure from his family for him to have a son, because in his branch of the family, nobody had had a male heir. And so he was very serious about this, and he wanted to marry a respectable woman. And God knows, Olga, the Russian ballerina, was nothing if not respectable.
The woman he met in Italy.
Yeah, he met, who was a dancer with Diaghilev. And
respectable to the point where she wouldn't sleep with him. Every other woman seemed to be willing to sleep
with him. I think that she was the first woman who said no. And I think he regarded this as a tremendous challenge, and then fell into the trap of, you know, no screwing until the ring's on the finger. And I think in the end, when she knew he was going to marry her, that she melted a bit. And I think that Picasso was not somebody who was going to sit still while there was a pretty girl around. And the tragedy was that a few weeks before they were going to get married in 1918, in the spring of 1918, Olga got out of bed one day and couldn't put her foot on the ground, and something had gone, she'd torn a ligament, we don't know quite what had happened. And she went into a sanatorium for a few days. They let her go out. She was much, much worse. And when she was married on a stick. And that's why there are no wedding photographs of her. And I looked and looked and looked and finally found a photograph of her, not actually at the wedding, but in her wedding dress, done a few days later on the honeymoon. And she's got a stick. And
a cane.
A cane. Mm-hmm. And she remained on a cane until for quite a few months, until September. And for Picasso to have a lame ballerina wife must have been hell. I mean, everything that he would have disturbed him.
Let's get back to Cocteau, because they seem like an odd couple, although Cocteau was obviously influenced by Picasso's drawing style. Sometimes you almost can't tell whether it's a Cocteau or a Picasso, but they seem like such different personalities.
Yes, but Cocteau was enormously useful to Picasso. I mean, Cocteau was the one who really got Picasso into the world of the Ballet Russe, and the sort of fancy world of Paris, the beau monde, I mean, the great parties, the balls which were given. And Picasso enjoyed it, and Olga enjoyed it even more. And this new life in Paris is reflected in the respectability of his work, the respectability of his images of his wife. And where he goes back to Ingres for a style, and they are a reaction against cubism, but they're also they reflect the way Picasso had taken a big apartment in Paris in a very respectable part of the town, got a butler with white gloves, a big car with a driver, for the child, a fencing master, a dancing master, a skating master, and it was a very, very bourgeois setup.
Kind of shocking for a man who had really presented himself as the great bohemian.
Yeah, well, who was a great bohemian and remained a great bohemian. I think that this was the only exceptional time that when he really became a sort of part of this sort of haute bourgeois life in Paris. And Cocteau was really the impresario of this, and he introduced Picasso to everybody. And in doing so, he fell madly in love with Picasso. And I think you can say that Cocteau was in love with Picasso for his entire life.
But he was gay, and they couldn't have a relationship. Cocteau actually took some female lovers in an effort to be like Picasso?
Yes. I mean, Cocteau was such a copycat. I mean, when Picasso ended up with this beautiful ballerina, Olga, Cocteau immediately felt he had to have a beautiful ballerina. And Maria Chabelska, who was this pretty sweet girl who had a rather disastrous career in that she was, of all the people, was booed to bits when Parade, the ballet which Picasso had worked on, was first shown in Paris.
Eric Satie's.
Yeah, Satie, Massine, and Picasso. And but Cocteau's relationship with Picasso hadn't been gone into before, and it was absolutely fascinating because Cocteau would almost deliberately annoy Picasso, do things to irritate him, and Picasso would punish Cocteau, which I think he rather enjoyed, and this is the pattern of their relationship for the next 30 years or so.
My guest is John Richardson, whose latest volume in his life of Picasso is The Triumphant Years, 1917 to 1932, published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with John Richardson, the author of a memoir called The Sorcerer's Apprentice, an essay collection, Sacred Monsters, Sacred Masters, books on Manet and Braque. He's also written for the New York Review of Books, the New Yorker, and Vanity Fair, and was instrumental in setting up Christie's in the United States. He has been working on the most comprehensive biography of Pablo Picasso, and now A Life of Picasso is in its third volume, The Triumphant Years, 1917-1932, published by Knopf. So Picasso marries Olga, and he and his friends are kind of disapproving, but he comes fairly quickly to be repulsed by her.
No, I don't think he was repulsed by her. I think she, poor thing, she got ill. I mean, as I said before, she had this terrible accident to her leg. I think she had very, very bad luck.
Yeah, but he painted her as a monster at a certain point. Paintings of her as one monster after another. Did she deserve that?
That's much later. I mean, at first he's in love with her. He's very proud of her. And the portraits of her are never sexy, as most of his female portraits are. But they are admiring, and he shows her as a beautiful woman in a sort of neoclassical way, and they are marvelous and grotesque images. It's only later when he, in 1927, when he picks up this girl outside the Galerie Lafayette and falls madly in love with her, a 17-year-old girl called Marie-Thérèse Walter, that he gets very irritated with Olga, who makes scenes, who is far from well. We don't know what was wrong with her. She had always going back into sanatoriums and making terrible scenes. I mean, she used to accuse him of not being the father of the boy, Polo, who was born to them, although there's absolutely no question then. I mean, Polo was very much his son. And she used to stick her tongue out at him. I mean, the amount of images of her when he turns against her, she's got her tongue like a dagger sticking out of her mouth. And then the images of the girlfriend, Marie-Thérèse, are much more languorous and beautiful and exceedingly sexy.
To the point where one of the famous paintings has her with a almost a penis on her face.
Well, that's the famous The Dream, where she's seated in a chair. And it's rightly called The Dream. Picasso didn't give titles to most of his paintings. So this one is The Dream, and she has got sex on the brain. She's got part of her face is arranged like a penis on top of her head, and then she makes a kind of vaginal gesture with her hands between her legs. So we know what she's dreaming about. But meanwhile, poor Olga was treated very badly, and she's... As she was a ballerina, we can always realize, we can always identify her in his work, because usually she is in the fifth position, of the ballet dancer's famous fifth position, with her arms linked over her head, like an arch. And Picasso has much fun with this particular thing, and poor Olga is shown enraged, slightly crazed, a gaping mouth in one case. She's turned into the murderess what was the name of the woman who murdered Charlotte Corday, who married the revolutionary leader, that is a fiendish image of Charlotte Corday sort of pouncing on and stabbing the Marat figure, but who in fact stands for Picasso in this particular painting. And there's a lot of blood oozing out all over the floor. And there are various other images like that, very Goyesque images, very cruel. But as Picasso, I'm sure, felt, he was an exorcist, and he'd rather sort of exorcise his wife's demons than take it out on her personally. I think that this is all he used art. Art, he always felt, should have a magic function. And in this case, I mean, the magic function was an exorcistic one. And I think that these terrible paintings of poor Olga should be seen as exorcisms.
Well, how did he probably tried out more styles than any other artist in the history of the world. And do you see them as a kind of a dialogue with each other? And we go from cubism to neoclassicism. And at the same time, he's painting these absolutely monstrous abstracted paintings of Olga. He's painting these very sweet paintings of Marie-Thérèse.
I think the image, the changes in Picasso's imagery is inspired by the subject matter. I mean, by Olga and by Marie-Thérèse. And I don't think that he sat down and thought up a new approach to imagery, to portraiture. I think that it just emerged from his work, emerged from his feelings, and his feelings for Olga were obviously, by this time, rather punitive. But with all the Marie-Thérèses, I mean, she is seen as a wonderful sort of moon goddess, voluptuous, they are some of the greatest sort of love portraits, sex portraits of all the history and all the history of art.
And Olga must have known that he was having this affair.
I think Olga soon found out. At first, I think she was enraged and made a lot of scenes. But then I think she felt that anything better than what he'd been doing before, which was going out and picking up girls in the Grand Boulevard, and at least Marie-Thérèse, she must have sensed, was extremely good girl and was not going to be any trouble to anybody, had no desire to be Madame Picasso, the Châtelaine of Boisgeloup. I mean, she wanted to be herself. She was insanely in love with Picasso, and indeed so much so that 50 years after they first met, and 4 or 5 years after Picasso's death, she committed suicide because she couldn't bear the idea of life without him.
Didn't Picasso tell the women he met that they should read the Marquis de Sade?
Yes, he did.
Was that a clue as to the kind of power relationship?
I think that's partly a clue, but I don't think it was as crude as it might seem. I mean, I don't think he liked beating up on women. He certainly wasn't a wife beater. But he was a control freak, and I think that what he took from the Marquis de Sade was this feeling that the girl in his life had to be his object, his possession, and that she shouldn't look him in the eye, certainly when they were making love, that she should be submissive. And it's the submissiveness which is Sadian, I think, more than anything else.
During the time of his affair with Marie-Thérèse and his marriage to Olga, he was painting nearly a painting a day. When did he find the time to make love to the one and argue with the other? And I suspect go to brothels once in a while.
Well, I think that the paintings of Marie-Thérèse, I mean, it's very difficult to draw a line between Picasso involving himself in the creative act because he also at the same time is involved in the procreative act. And so you get the paintings are really all about, are a lot about sex, and so you have him, you really feel the atmosphere of the studio, which is partly a place for creating art, but also a place for making love to the model, who's also... Who has inspired the art?
The painting that we talked about earlier, Dream, is now at a Las Vegas casino, and you say that it's been sullied by that. Does it really matter where a painting is exhibited? In the end, it'll wind up somewhere else won't it?
I don't think it matters where a painting is, so long as it's properly looked after. And I know Steve Wynn looks after this painting reasonably well, except that he, by mistake, put his elbow through it as he was about to sell it for $138 million to Steve Cohen. Now, this seems a grotesque price for this painting, which is not one of, at least in my view, one of the first 20 Picassos in importance. But I think that what Steve wanted and the buyer and seller wanted was to have a record price. And this was $3 million more than it had been paid for the Klimt by Ronald Lauder.
So now the other thing, not only did Picasso kind of paint a form of diary, a running biography, he also addressed his rivalry with André Matisse through some of the paintings, didn't he?
Yes, but I think we have to go carefully here because...
You can see messages there.
There are indeed messages, but I think that the one sad thing that resulted from that beautiful show of Matisse and Picasso, which was in London, Paris, and New York, is that people now seem to think of them as two wrestlers, two contestants, and which is the better, which was the stronger, who won. And this is not at all what the exhibition was supposed to do, but this is the impression left by the exhibition. So people are always saying to me, who's the best? And and they're both great painters, and I think it's not fair to either of them to see them always in opposition to the other.
We have very little time, but was Picasso political at this point?
Picasso was desperately apolitical. He tried until the Spanish Civil War. He was determined to stay above the fray and not get lured by André Breton, the surrealist, into Marxism. I mean, he hated Marxism, he hated Freudianism, he hated dream states, which the surrealists were always so keen on. And he even in 1934 went so far as to accept an invitation from José Antonio Primo de Rivera, the head of the Falange, the inventor of Spanish fascism, to go to San Sebastian and be guest of honor at a dinner. And a year later, he would have completely changed his mind when the revolution broke out and became the great anti-fascist painter he was.
Now, you have one volume left to complete. You'll be 84 in February, and you have 40 years to cover. Some might argue that, except for the beginning, these are the least interesting years as far as his art is concerned. Is that the way you see it, or do you think that a fifth volume is going to be required, perhaps by somebody else?
Well, I couldn't possibly do a fifth volume. I mean, fourth volume is going to be pretty tough, but I'm going to have some other writer to sort of help me along with that. No, I think the fourth volume, a lot of it, is a great deal of it is extremely important. I mean, we have his involvement with bullfighting, we have Guernica coming up, we have World War II, and I will try and the rest of his life, which is much quieter, I'll try and complete that.
John Richardson will be in conversation at the New York Public Library on January 24th. Details on our show page. Thank you so much for being with us today.